I'm going to say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And I've got two special guests today, but it is actually Lark who's sitting in as my co-host as we interview Alfred Adask, and I have them both back because I have had them both on numerous programs, and well, Alfred on one program, and Lark has sat in with me several times in the past on both my radio programs, but I would, and Lark has a radio program now that he didn't have. And he's been on Republic Broadcasting as his program is called Just a Numerican. And I want to say hi, Lark.
Well, hi, Melody.
Hi. And then we've got Alfred at us. And I'm going to, Alfred, I'm going to let you describe yourself a little bit since my printer got a little bit carried away on your bio.
Well, you explained that it printed 50 pages, and I know my bio is not 50 pages long. Unless you've written it in very large letters. If you can only get 5 or 10 letters on a page, then maybe. But I went through a divorce back in 1983. I suffered what I thought was a great injustice. I had been working construction up until that point. I had a little roofing business of my own. And I became a student of the legal system. The intent was to rectify the injustice I thought I'd suffered at the divorce court level. And one thing led to another, and I started studying the law, and I thought it would take me anywhere from 18 months to maybe 3 years to straighten out the problem. And here we are 28 years later, and I still haven't straightened out the problem. But I did become a student and even obsessed with the law to some degree, and ran for the Supreme Court of Texas in 1992. The government registered me, listed me as one of the top dozen anti-government activists of the 1990s. They were particularly impressed by the fact that I'd managed to get on the ballot for the Supreme Court of Texas, which is supposed to be illegal. I found an 1870 federal law that said I could. And they were much surprised to see the great unwashed get up on the ballot. Did Citizens for Legal Reform, started a group here in Dallas, biggest legal reform group in the country, through the 1990s at least. Published the Anti-Shyster News magazine for 12 years. And in the last 7 years, I've been hosting my own radio programs and I write for the International Forecaster and publish on my own blog and so on. And I remain an activist, and I'm still trying to settle the score for that divorce back in 1983. I'm the kind of person, apparently, who can hold a grudge for some period of time.
Well, welcome. Whether you would like to admit it or not, then it has definitely led into some directions you probably wouldn't have gone otherwise.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely. Changed my life in ways that, it's one of those things where you suffer a certain amount of loss, but there have been some spectacular gains and things that I would never have expected. And the most surprising thing about all of it is you start studying the law long enough and you begin to understand the religious and spiritual foundation for the law. And you study it, at least in my case, long enough, and eventually it brings you kicking and screaming back to God. It wasn't what I was looking for. It certainly wasn't what I expected, but it has been the single great blessing of the last 28 years.
Now, we did get to cover a little bit of the issue on animal and
man or other animals.
Man or other animals in our mm-hmm. first interview with you. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, while I was preparing for this program, I ran across several programs that you had done with other guests that you have on your program. And then again, with the background that Lark has, we wanted to kind of go in a little bit different direction. Lark, do you have any questions that you'd like to get started with?
Well, I'd like to say to start off, I wish I had known you in 1999 and 2000 now, because I was at that time negotiating with the city of Dallas for a long-term lease. And that's when I discovered how truly corrupt government was.
Yeah, it's like making sausage or potato chips. You know, if you like to eat those things, you don't want to go in the factory where they're made.
Oh, my. You're so right. I'm interested in things like religio-philosophy and how it ties into what is euphemistically and very generally simply called law. I was listening to a program one night, Al, and I noticed that just on a single sheet of notebook paper, I think I, off the top of my head, wrote down 50 different types of law. Public law, private law, treaty law, international law, constitutional law, state law, federal law, as you understand. And it's quite a bewildering subject, as you, I'm sure, appreciate.
Yep.
I would like to begin, if I might, Al, with your definition of the word law.
Well, ultimately, it's a kind of agreement where people agree that within a particular community or body politic, the people agree that we will not do this, that, or the other, or we will do some other things. There are times when the government will exceed the notion. They say, we don't need the public's consent. We don't need an agreement. We're just going to tell all those dummies out there what to do. And when the government begins to do that, we begin to slide into tyranny and fascism. But the public eventually revolts. If the government gets so arrogant that it begins to exceed the agreement, and it becomes clear, then the people are going to say, you know, we're out of here. We quit. Get in our way, we'll shoot you. And then you have a real revolution. And my point is, you can go through periods of time when there does not appear to be an agreement between the governed and the government. You know, it can seem that the government is in so much control that the governed has no say. But that rectifies itself. There's, you know, it's, you know, over time, eventually the governed stand up and say, we're not doing it that way. We're doing it this way. And when that happens, you have a revolution.
Now, could we say it's a social contract of a sort?
Yeah, we could say that. I mean, it's one of those things where you can do better definitions than the one I've just given you. But shooting from the hip, that's my definition du jour.
Well, I can appreciate that. And, of course, we could come up with a new definition on a daily basis, probably. However, that's a very good definition.
Well, you know, there's one other aspect to the law also. And it's the idea that for every right, there is a correlative duty. The law typically involves, I can't do this. And the flip side of it is somebody's got an obligation to make sure it doesn't happen or something along those lines. But law always runs in a right and a duty. Somebody's got the right, somebody's got the duty. There has to be a certain equilibrium, there has to be a certain balance. If there is no right, there is no duty. If there's no duty, there's no right. So the law, in theory, sometimes the right and the duty are implied rather than expressed, but that would be another variation on the definition.
So do we have serious problems with the law in America today?
Yeah, darn right. Sure we do. For example, the question gets down to who's the boss? I mean, there's the fundamental question in the law. I can write a law right now. I can sit here at my computer. I can write a law. I can write a law and I can say, Melody and Lark are bound to do this, that, and the other because I've just said so. I wrote the law. Well, Melody and Lark can sit back and say, we don't have to pay any attention to you. You don't have to obey the laws I've written. The question becomes, who are we going to obey? Who is in charge? And therefore, who has authority to make the laws? And one of the things that's happened in this country, we started out with the idea that the people are the source of all political power. The people are the ultimate sovereign in this country, and they are the ones who make the first level of man-made law. Do you know what the people's law is, Lark?
No, please elaborate.
Constitution. We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The people, we get confused. People look back and they say, oh, Madison or whoever wrote the Constitution. It doesn't matter who wrote it. All right? They could have had Joe the janitor could have written the Constitution. It's irrelevant who wrote it. What's relevant is who ratified it. It's like me. I can sit here and write a law that binds everybody in the country, but if nobody ratifies, it doesn't mean anything. The point is the people ratified the Constitution. The Constitution is the people's law. The people created a government, and they said, we're going to give you certain limited powers, and you can pass laws over here in the federal legislature, in Congress. You can pass laws over here within these limits. That's the only power we're giving you, within these limits. Don't you go outside those limits. And over time, the Congress and the president and the judiciary have essentially worked together to start running their own system of laws. And these are the government's laws as opposed to the people's laws. The people's laws are supposed to be higher and more powerful than the government's laws. But anyone who studies this any length of time understands that the Constitution is largely ignored by the government. We see where federal courts are routinely making rulings. In the Supreme Court are making rulings where they are stripping the Fourth Amendment, they're stripping the Fifth Amendment. The protections are being a little at a time and a little bit more and a little bit more, and they just said, well, we've got to. They are constantly making exceptions where the government is allowed to ignore the people's law.
Where do you think it all went wrong? Or when do you think it all went wrong, Al?
Marbury versus Madison. Do you know that case at all?
Well, I'm vaguely familiar. That once you refresh my memory and our memory,
it goes back to about 1803. Yeah, the Constitution had only been in effect for, at that point, what, I think 89, it'd be 11, 14, 15 years, somewhere along the line. And I may not have the date correct on Marbury versus Madison, but it's regarded as one of the single most important case in American jurisprudence. Some people make that argument, and it's certainly a contender for that. And I think it's probably correct. And what happened in Marbury versus Madison is that the Supreme Court declared that the Supreme Court would be the ultimate decider. I'm missing a word here. But the Supreme Court would be the ultimate authority to decide what the Constitution means. And when they did that, they opened up an opportunity for people who sit on the bench to constantly twist and move the meanings of certain parts of the Constitution, change them just a little bit, change them a little bit more. It's like the Constitution says you got to face due north. And the Supreme Court comes in and says, well, you could face just a little bit to the east, just a couple degrees to the east. That would be okay, too. And the next court comes in and says, well, you could a couple more degrees. And before you know it, they keep on moving it a couple more degrees and a couple more degrees. And instead of facing due north, you're facing due south. By increments, they are taking the Constitution apart. And they're doing it because Marbury versus Madison declared that the Supreme Court would be the ultimate arbiter of deciding what the Constitution means. Here's my problem with that. The Constitution is the people's law. It's not the government's law. It's the people's law. I believe that it would have been better to sit back and say, nope. All constitutes, given that the Constitution is the people's law, it was written, authorized by the people. Let the people decide what their law means. That means that if you're going to raise a constitutional issue, you go in front of a jury and let a jury of your peers, you'll make your constitutional issue. And it's not up to the judge to decide what the Constitution says. It's up to the people in your community, the people on the jury to say, well, Yeah, I think when we talk about the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, I think this is what it means. And maybe they agree with you, and maybe they don't. And the people in the next jury or the next community, they might have a different take on it. But the Constitution would remain as written, and it would be subject to interpretation by the people, not by the courts. Now, I know that a lot of people sit back and say, well, that's silly. You can't let all those idiots out there in TV land decide what the Constitution means. And I think the truth is you can. And I think it would be a better country if we did.
Okay, Alfred, my question is, over the course of listening to many different speakers and researchers around this arena, is that there's more than one Constitution.
Yeah, I've heard that. That argument, depending on which argument you're making, is not necessarily invalid. I've seen reference to the Constitution from 1887, and I've also, and I know that it was ratified in 1787, and also 1789. In 1787, the Constitution was written, and it was then sent out to the states for ratification. It was accepted by the Congress, but it wasn't ratified. Under the terms of the Constitution, it wasn't ratified until the ninth state ratified, and I believe that was 1789. So the Constitution, there have been instances where it appears that the government sometimes relies on the Constitution as ratified or accepted by Congress in 1787 rather than as ratified and accepted by the people in 1789. What that means, whether that is just a bizarre conspiracy theory or has significant meaning, you know, we can speculate on it. But that's the kind of question that would be, in my opinion, eliminated if every time there was a constitutional issue, it was up to the people. It's the people's law. Let the people tell you what it means. Right?
And how might that mechanism be implemented?
If I were suing on a constitution, I had a constitutional argument, not just a statutory argument, but a constitutional argument. I said, these guys violated the Constitution when they came to my home and seized my guns. Okay? I make my pitch, my presentation to the jury based on that constitutional argument. And I said, here's what the Second Amendment says. And that necessarily means I get to keep my guns. Now, if the 12 jurors are going to sit there and they're going to say, they could say yes, they could say no. They would not change the words of the Constitution. They might agree with me. They might disagree with me. But it would not affect the jury in the next township or the next county or the next state that faced the same issue. The people, local people, would make the call. We wouldn't be relying on a Supreme Court to tell us what the Constitution meant. And if we ran into serious problems with this, well, there's the big benefit on this. It would force people to learn about the Constitution. Because almost everyone would probably have an opportunity to do jury duty one time or another. And a constitutional issue would come up. And so people would learn about the Constitution, where most people right now don't have a clue to what's going on. And in the event that we found that we had problems with the Constitution, you could look at Article 7, if I recall correctly. Article 7 says ratification of, that talks about ratification of the in any case, there's proviso in the Constitution for amending the document. We have federal courts right now and a Supreme Court, and they insist that this is a living document and that its meaning is subject to change. And who is going to determine what that meaning is, what the new meaning is? Well, a bunch of licensed attorneys now sitting at the Supreme Court or federal court level. And they excuse these changes in meanings. They say this is a living document, meaning that the meaning of the document changes over time. And that's absolutely crap.
Well, you know, one of the things that comes up that I've heard recently that that I believe it was Noah Webster who had come out with the dictionary so that they would quit changing the interpretation of the terminology. And whether this is true or not, one of the things that I'm watching on a daily basis is you've got all these think tanks and whatever that is creating law, and it seems to me the essence of what is going on out there is there isn't a law out there that you can't find a way around. And then it comes back to the ethical aspects of people that are implementing or not implementing these laws. What do you say to that?
Well, I say it all depends on what the meaning of is. Right? And that was a famous remark made by former President Bill Clinton when he was being tried for when he was being impeached. Right? Mm-hmm. And it sounded like some smart ass remark you might get from any licensed attorney, but in fact it was a very profound statement. It is the law is ultimately all about words. And if you can't read and write and speak fluently, you're going to have a terrible problem dealing with those words. On the other hand, if you become adept at the English language, if you become fluent in the English language, all of a sudden you become a dangerous man simply because you can master definitions and grammar. And all of a sudden, you can read these things. And we mentioned, I'd been on your program once before, talked about man or other animals. I was sued by the Attorney General of the state of Texas for $25,000 a day. That's $9 million a year. I was the seventh of seven defendants in the case. The case started in 2001. I wasn't added till 2006. I read the relevant law, and it involved the manufacture and distribution of drugs. And the drug in this instance was colloidal silver, which is an inexpensive antibiotic. I read the definition of drugs in the federal law, and I read it in the Texas law, and I was astonished to realize the definition of drugs presumes the people to be animals, not men and women. And I understood enough about the Bible to say, you can't declare me to be an animal. My Bible says at Genesis 1:26 through 28 that on the sixth day God created man in his image and gave man dominion over the animals. As a Christian or a Jew and probably as a Muslim, you can't declare people to be animals without violating their freedom of religion. I drafted a freedom of religion law, defense in this case, and we ran it at them, and they dropped the case. They didn't drop it instantly. It took them about a year. First thing they did is went dead silent for 5 months, and then they spent 5 months trying to settle a case, and then they dropped it after investing 6 years and nearly $500,000 in the pretrial hearings and investigation. They just dropped it. Why? Because I could read. I saw the meaning of the word. The phrase is man or other animals. I knew instantly what it meant. It didn't say man or animals. It said man or other animals. It's like saying a horse or other animals, or a bird or other animals, or a robin or other animals. You say a man or other animals, it means they deem mankind to be animals. They are, and which incidentally is an act of genocide, but regardless, it was by reading and understanding definitions, I was able to stop a suit where the Attorney General of Texas had invested $500,000. They'd had previous lawyers in the situation. The first three defendants hired one of the best law firms in Texas and spent $160,000. And the lawyers got nowhere, just drove these people into bankruptcy. I read the law, and to the best of my knowledge, I'm the first man to read it in 100 years and understand what it means. We traced the man or other animals phrase all the way back to the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906. Been there for 100 years. The whole war on drugs is premised on the idea that we are nothing but livestock. It's an absolute violation of fundamental principles this nation started on. Larky, we're talking about, I'm not sure the phrase you used, but something like
religio-philosophy.
All right, religio-philosophy. This goes back to the foundation of this country. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We celebrate that principle every 4th of July, although the average man has no clue. Average American thinks the 4th of July is a three-day holiday. You get an extra day to get drunk on the weekend, you get sunburned, you go out and fix steaks or hamburgers, you know, go swimming, play volleyball, whatever, watch the fireworks. What are we celebrating on 4th of July? Very few people understand. We are celebrating the principles on which this country began. And they're there, right there in that document. The first one is that we each get our rights directly from God. These rights, they come to men. They don't go to persons. The unalienable, the God-given unalienable rights, they don't go to persons. They don't go to citizens. They don't go to inhabitants. The Declaration says we hold these truths to be self-evident, meaning no proof is necessary for these truths. And the first one is all men are created equal, and second, they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. But there is no self-evident truth for persons or inhabitants or citizens or residents or any one of a number of different devices they can use that try to get you away from your standing as a man made in God's image and endowed by your Creator with certain unalienable rights. If you can go back and assert that, at least in my instance, that we were able to assert that, and the Attorney General dropped a case. And I'll bet you that you can't find another story like that. It depends on what the meaning of is, and that's no joke. You know, one of the things I've been telling people on the radio program on a fairly regular basis.
And give your website while you're at it. And
people can go over to adask.wordpress.com. It's a blog we draw. 1,500 people per 1,500 views per day. It's not big time, but it's in the top percentile of blogs in this country. That doesn't mean much. You got so many blogs that you got to be in the top tenth of a percent to actually amount to anything. But I'm doing better than 99% of the blogs in this country. What was I going to say? I don't recall exactly. I had something else in mind. Skip my mind. I don't know. Does this make any sense?
Oh yeah.
The point I'm trying to make on this is that when we talk about law, we're finally going to talk about authority. Who says? Who's in charge? Who's the boss? Why do I have God-given unalienable rights? Because God said so.
But you're also...
I can rest my argument on the God of the Bible.
Okay, but you're also stating that you got to be able to have a command of the language and what words...
Oh, absolutely.
And what words mean. Right.
Absolutely. It's all about words. You can look at Texas Penal Code 1, Section 1, which is general provisions, .04, which is territorial jurisdiction, and subsection D. So it'd be 1.04 subsection D of the Texas Penal Code, and it describes the territorial jurisdiction of this state. And it says this state includes the land and the water, and the airspace above the land and the water, over which this state has power to define offenses. If you accept their definitions, you're subject to their jurisdiction. If you don't accept their if you can present an alternative set of definitions where you reject the definitions of the terms they're using, you are not in the jurisdiction of this state. It's about definitions. With what I was going to mention before, as I've been telling people for some time, a lot of people think you're going to have to get into a shooting revolution to deal with the government, and it might come to that. We would hope not. But I've been telling people, you need to have at least as many dictionaries as you have guns. You need to be at least as adept at speaking as you are at shooting. And when you can master, all right, you begin to master the language, all of a sudden you become a dangerous individual. You'll be surprised. This whole government runs on words. And if you can handle the words, if you can read and write at a high level, it's not for, you're not likely to do it with an eighth grade reading level. But to the extent you can read, you can hold the system at bay.
So the idea that you have kids sitting and using these little text machines that use everything in abbreviation and just have destroyed the language and usage of it works right into the hands of those who want to have control over us.
Absolutely. You'll see people in the young kids in the black community. They make it becomes part of their culture to not learn to speak, with precision. And they think it's cool. They think learning to, talk white, right? That's dumb, baby. That's not cool. You got to be cool. You know what I'm talking about? You understand? You don't have to learn to spell. I guarantee you, if you're going to accept the idea that you don't need to master the language, then you would need to accept the idea that you are going to live as a servant or a slave in this society.
But you also have to realize that it doesn't matter what a profession you go into, you've got a whole new terminology to work with. So it's anytime you pick up a new technology or a new avocation, you name it, you're having to learn a new language.
Except for computers. With computers, you just blame the machine. That's all. I don't need to learn anything about computers. The machine, that's what screwed up. It wasn't me. It was the machine or the program or something, but it wasn't me.
Okay, Lark, you got anything to...
Well, several things. The first thing I'd like to add, because I want to go to something called maxims of law and touch upon that. And I'll just throw out a few things that are just thoughts and respond any way you wish. First of all, I don't think that the colonies actually won their independence as sovereigns. And the reason I say that is because the first clue is the ignoring of the Lockean precepts of life, liberty, and property, and substituting what has been termed Rosicrucian language of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I think this was a result of Jefferson's and Franklin's wanting to ingratiate themselves in French and English or European society. And the truth is that when we look at the Treaty of Ghent that ended the War of 1812, and we look at the Treaty of Paris, which ended the War for Independence, and then we couple that with the language in Johnson v. McIntosh, 1823, John Marshall Court, and we understand that these colonies were, in essence, corporations of their time.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And then
I agree
we look at things like, and then we look at things like the land patents and the land grants. We look at the law of Vattel's Law of Nations, and we have to ask ourselves if indeed we ever won. And I say we, I mean Americans, the colonists, if they actually won their sovereignty and territorial control.
Well, I can give you an answer for that. I can give you an authority you can point to, and that's Chisholm versus Georgia, which is about 1800. I don't remember. Again, it's in the vicinity of Marbury versus Madison. It might be 1796. It might be 1803. I don't recall. But Chisholm versus Georgia. And the Supreme Court declared that the people of the United States of America were sovereigns, plural, without subjects. Supreme Court got it. We got our independence. It was a real deal, and our government has been working mightily to take it away from us ever since. And the reason is, if you and I are sovereigns, the government is our servant. Government doesn't want to be your servant. They want to be our master. It is the essence of the battle that's going on, the struggle between the people and the government. Government wants to rule. They don't want to pay attention to people's law. People want to rule. They say, we don't want to have to pay attention to government's law. We have a conflict.
Okay, so Al...
It's on the side of the people.
So then somewhere along the line, this may have been one group not wanting to acknowledge the other group's...
Always.
Okay.
It's the same principle you find all the way back into Genesis with the story of Satan, Lucifer relative to God. Lucifer was a creation. He was God's number one. He was the most beautiful angel and so on. But he got tired of being a servant. He said, I don't want to be a servant. I want to rule. And now we have this conflict between God and Satan. It's a fundamental principle. The servants never want to serve. Washington, he described government. He said, government like fire is a dangerous servant or a fearful master. Best you get out of government is a dangerous servant. It means if you people trust the government, you be dumb. You show me somebody who trusts the government, I'll show you a lousy excuse for an American.
Well, after all, the word government itself means controller of the mind.
You know, it might be. I don't know.
And when we relinquish the control of our own minds,
sure,
then we're certainly not sovereign.
You can relinquish some of the control, and you can maintain your sovereignty. The whole idea behind the government, behind the Constitution, is that we the people were sovereigns. We granted certain limited powers. We agreed to grant certain limited powers, limited aspects of our sovereignty to the government, but we retained all the rest for ourselves. We didn't abandon our sovereignty, but we compromised it.
What do you think?
Let me ask you another question. What do you think it means when you mention the pursuit of happiness? How do you define that term or that phrase?
Well, the problem with that is that it gives rise to a lot of ambiguity, even within the English language. It also, happiness is a conditional thing, of course. And unfortunately, I still think there's a problem because the precepts of John Locke were well known to the so-called founding fathers at that time. And for whatever reason, I can point to one other thing, but beyond the fact that life, liberty, and property was excluded for life, liberty, and happiness is also what happened with the so-called original 13th Amendment. I can't probably answer your question very
well. I can give you an answer. I can give you an answer, and I saw this years ago in one of the, I think I saw it, I don't recall. I saw it in one of the early dictionaries, and it might have been Webster's 1828. It might have been Bouvier's. It might have been one of Bouvier's first dictionaries. I saw it. And it registered in my mind, and it was not, they didn't find pursuit of happiness. It wasn't under that heading. I found reference to it somewhere else, and it stuck in my mind. I understood what I read, but I don't recall precisely where I read it, but here's what it said. It said essentially that the pursuit of happiness is freedom of religion. In the final analysis, Lark, we can give you a couple of, we're going to put you up in front of three doors, and behind door number one, we have a blonde with a big set of bazooms, and behind door number two, we got ourselves a new Ferrari, and behind door number three, we have eternal salvation. Now, you get to pick whichever one you want for your maximum happiness. Which one are you going to take?
Eternal salvation.
You darn right. That's what they were talking about with the pursuit of happiness. It's religious freedom. That's what was intended. And the first time I saw it, I understood instantly that that made perfect sense. I get it. It's not just the right to go to Disney World or something.
Do you think there was not some serious conflicts between a Christian's reading of the Bible and even the Old Testament and, for instance, say, a Freemason's or a Jew's reading of the Bible and the confusion of language in that regard?
I don't doubt that there's plenty of conflict, but the idea when you asked me to define law, and I said, it's an agreement, all right? The majority of people at the time agreed that this was the law we were going to be bound by, and they ignored, there may have been a handful of Jews there that said, hey, I don't think this is what we think, and they said, well, we don't care. You're 1% of the population, and we're 98. We're going to do it our way. Don't like it? Don't let the door hit you in the butt on the way out. Same goes, it was a question of a majority of people got together and they drafted a set of laws and values and they said, this is what we agree on. This is for us. And we're going to play by these rules in the same sense that we could get together and we could say, well, let's have a game. Game of what? Game of basketball, football, baseball, cards? What are we going to play? Different set of rules. We will agree to the rules of the game we're going to play, the contest. This was a similar, this from my perspective, it's the same thing. It's political.
And, okay, when you talk about the Constitution and these being agreements, then you throw in the thing such as treaties, because I was listening to something you on a program you did recently about some work done by Roger Sales and an interpretation, and Dennis Craig had mentioned something to the effect that, you know, it was defined more so by international interpretation.
It can be. I think it's, what is it? I don't remember right off the top of my head, but it's probably Article 3, where they talk about the supreme law of the land includes this Constitution and the treaties made in accordance therewith shall be the supreme court, the supreme law of the land. They allowed treaties to be, they allowed treaties in the terms of the Constitution to be treated as, in a sense, co-equal with the original Constitution as written. But it says, and I don't have it right here in front of me, so I can't quote it to you accurately, but it says, the treaties made in accordance with the Constitution shall be the supreme law of the land. It doesn't say just any treaty that these bozos can go out there. Well, let's sign a treaty, and then we'll control everybody. No, not that's not what the Constitution says. Now, I know the government says that you can do it that way. But the truth is the Constitution says, yeah, you can sign treaties within the limits that we have imposed on you in the first place. Huh? Government can sign those treaties within the limits imposed by the Constitution. Government cannot exceed those limits and expect the people to go along with the program. Of course, they've managed to do it because most people have been dumbed down to where, you know, they can barely speak. They can rap, perhaps, but how many of them can speak anymore?
Lark, you had some questions getting into that international aspect.
Well, I wanted to first of all touch upon the historical aspect of the original 13th Amendment, if you had any thoughts about that, Al.
Well, David Dodge and Tom Dunn discovered that original 13th Amendment up in a library in Belfast, Maine, back about, 1990, all right, about that time. And I know because David Dodge brought all his research to me about 1991, 92. I'd started publishing the Anti-Shyster. He had the mistaken impression that I was reaching something like a quarter of a million people, and in fact, I was printing maybe 10,000 copies per issue. He thought I was putting out a quarter million. He drove all the way from Maine down there, delivered the paperwork to me, his evidence. He'd written some articles on it. I researched it, and I published three different articles in the Anti-Shyster, and I was probably the first person, other than Dodge and Dunn, to realize what was going on. And the story of this 13th Amendment is that when the Bill of Rights was proposed in, 1791, my recollection, they proposed 13 amendments. Only 10 were adopted. One of the three that was proposed was a Title of Nobility Amendment, which prohibited titles of nobility. Right. And it specified that if you accepted a title of nobility or honor, you would forfeit your citizenship. That was the penalty. Titles of nobility are still prohibited for both the states of the Union and for the federal government. They can't grant them. It says they can't grant them in the Constitution. They're still prohibited, but there's no attached penalty. The 13th Amendment said you lose your citizenship, meaning you wouldn't be allowed to participate in government any further if you invade. The title of nobility was any advantage or privilege that one individual or group enjoyed over another. And the reason when this was first seen, Dodge and Dunn saw this and said, my God, this means that the title of nobility got all these lawyers and they're claiming to be esquires. And it's a title of nobility and we can wipe out the freaking licensed attorneys. And I read it and I said, yeah, that's probably true, but this is way bigger than that. It meant no special interest legislation. You can't pass a law where we are going to take money from one person and give it to another person without effectively granting a title of nobility. You can't have unequal tax rates. You can't have laws that favor one section of the country at the expense of another section of the country. The only laws Congress could write under that original 13th Amendment were the laws that served everyone in the nation equally, and the result would be that you could probably convene Congress for about 2 months every year maximum. There wouldn't be anything for them to do. If they couldn't do special interest legislation, there would be almost nothing for Congress to do. It would have stripped the government. It was probably the single most important amendment that was ever attached to the Constitution.
Okay, now how would that have affected the states then?
Well, the federal government couldn't do any special interest legislation. And if the amendment, I'm trying to think, I believe the term only applied to the feds. I haven't looked at it for so long. This goes back to 20 years now. I don't know what the impact would be on the states. If the states wanted to do something stupid, they probably still could, but the feds could not. All right? No special interest legislation means you can't pass a law that gives one person an advantage and another person a disability.
What do you think about our former presidents and military commanders receiving knighthoods and such from the Queen?
I understand. There is so much that is so wrong, and it persists because the people are ignorant. All right?
Well, they were deliberately made so. The history books were altered. And by the way, I wanted to ask you, if I might, your definition for republic, and what do you think about this thing called democracy?
I think democracy? Yeah, I can give you a long dissertation on that. Most people would be very much surprised to learn that democracy is a collectivist form of government that's fundamentally identical to communism and socialism. If you already know that, the average person, you say that to an average person, like, well, that's crazy talk. No, it's not. Not if you understand how you discern the difference between one government, one form of government, and another.
But you know how I found that meaning was listening to foreigners speak about the terminology. That was when the clue came to me to start looking at those words and that what you're talking about.
Well, one of the big points is here we are fighting. We went to Iraq supposedly. One of our excuses was to give these people the benefit of democracy. We're going to just save the world by giving them all democracy. Mm-hmm. And they will all just bow down and worship us because we gave them democracy. All right? The word democracy does not appear in our Constitution.
Right.
In fact, what we are guaranteed is a Republican form of government, which is not necessarily the same as a republic. They use the phrase Republican form of government. And I don't know how much more time we have right now, Melody.
Well, we should have good close to an hour and 10 minutes if we get to.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure if we're doing 1 hour
or
we're doing.
No, it's two.
Okay, then we've got plenty of time. Republican form of government, they guarantee it in the Constitution. That the states shall be guaranteed, that the United States, meaning the federal government, shall guarantee to each state in the Union a Republican form of government. They don't specify what the Republican form of government is. But it's reasonable to assume that the Republican form of government was already in place in the 13 states which existed before we had the Constitution. What form of government did the 13 states have at the adoption of the Constitution? That has to be the Republican form of government, in my opinion. And the answer is they had a form of government that was consistent with the principles found in the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence created the individual states. And it said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. First principle, we all get unalienable rights from God. Second principle, third sentence, found in the third sentence of the Declaration, it says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. They are telling us that the purpose of government, as envisioned by the Founding Fathers, was to secure to every man, woman, and even unborn child their God-given unalienable rights. That is the essence of the Republican form of government. And most particularly, when you begin to study sovereignty, or at least when I begin to study sovereignty, first thing I learned is that sovereignty is an attribute that that comes from God. When you had a king in Europe, European king, the reason he was king is because he went through a coronation ceremony where he received a crown. And the crown was intended to emulate the corona that you see around the heads of the Christ and the saints in the medieval paintings. That crown was the way of telling the yokels out there in TV land that he was God's number one guy. He had the divine right of kings. He got his rights from God. And that's why he was sovereign. And all else were subjects because they did not get their rights directly from God. Now, when they started up at the Declaration of Independence, they said, to hell with that. We're not going to have a monarchy where just one man gets his rights from God. We are going to have a republican form of government, although they didn't use the term in the Declaration of Independence, but we're going to create a form of government that is virtually unprecedented. We will declare that all men get their rights directly from God. And when they made that declaration, they elevated all men to the status of sovereigns. Now, under that system that was created by the Declaration of Independence, God is number one, we the people are number two, and the government is number three. The government is relegated to the status of our public servant because we are the sovereigns, individual. You're a sovereign, I'm a sovereign, Lark's a sovereign. That was the intent. Government couldn't stand it. They've been trying to strip us of our individual sovereignty ever since. And their persistence and our ignorance has allowed them to, you know, they have succeeded, you know, to a very high degree, but it's not to say that we can't take it back. But in any case, my point is that the republican form of government, not just a republic, the republican form of government is a specific kind of republic. And it recognizes that each person is a sovereign. All right? You're a sovereign, I'm a sovereign, Lark's a sovereign. That's the republican form of government.
But it
democracy does not make that recognition at all.
But it since denies, it says you're saying ever since then, they've put many, many documents and the like in front of us and led us to believe that, we have signed away that sovereignty.
No, you can't sign it away. It's unalienable. It's declared in the Declaration to be unalienable. But you can waive it. You can act in a non-sovereign capacity. Are you the person who is hosting this radio program?
I think so.
Well, if you are, then you're acting in a non-sovereign capacity. You got to be the man or the woman.
Right. Huh? Right.
It's a word game. It is a word game, and you must dot your I's and cross your T's. And that's the way the game is played.
I think the people became servants to the masters with the money system, for sure. Do you think?
Oh, absolutely. That's part of it. See, one of the things about it is the third sentence in the Declaration of Independence says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. What are the governments that are among men? They didn't
contracts.
Say all governments. They said the governments are instituted among men. Which governments are among men?
I think it boils down to individual contracts, is it not?
Nope. No, I don't think so. The governments among men, not exactly. You might be able to stretch and say that. But the governments among men are the states of the union. All right?
How
the state of Texas, the state of Ohio, the state of Indiana. The states of the Union were the ones that were created by the Declaration of Independence. They became the Union. They were not in the Union until 5 years later with the Articles of Confederation. But the states were created by the first 13 states were created by the Declaration of Independence. And it says the purpose of these states is to secure to every man and woman and even unborn child their God-given unalienable rights. That's your purpose. Each one of those states was a government among men. Men made in God's image and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. What about the federal government? It says that Article 7 in the federal government says, wait a second, I need to, looking at the wrong one here. It says, ratification of the convention of nine states shall be sufficient for the establishment of this constitution between the states, so ratifying the same. It's not abundantly clear. I don't know the answer on this for sure. but it appears to me that the federal government created by the Constitution was never intended to be a government among men. The federal government never had an innate obligation to secure our God-given unalienable rights, and it's part of the reason why the Bill of Rights was added later on. But the federal government was to deal with states. It wasn't deal with men, was to deal with states. Now, there's a line here to what extent are states not composed of men. All right, when you say states, do we necessarily mean men or do we mean something else? It's arguable. The federal government never had the obligation to secure our God-given rights, but the states certainly did.
Aren't we talking about the inhabitants within a territorial bound?
Today?
When we're speaking about state citizens?
We are talking about, it appears that the government has set up an alternative venue, an alternative plane, an alternative reality, where Texas or State of Texas or TX signifies something other than the State of the Union. Part of the reason you can make that as allegation is because Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the Constitution of the United States declares in part, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. That section mandates that you've got to have gold and silver to pay your debts within the states of the Union. They, at the time the Constitution was drafted, the only kinds of states they had were the states of the Union. And they were essentially saying, no state of the Union shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. The government, the feds, removed the gold from domestic circulation in 1933. They removed silver by the end of 1968 from domestic circulation. When they did so, how did the governments of the states of the Union continue to function? The Constitution says they can't make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Since 1968, one of two things has to be true. Either your state government is acting in violation of the Constitution of the United States, which has never been amended to remove that mandate for gold and silver coin. They are violating the Constitution of the United States every time they write a check to pay their bills with Federal Reserve notes, or they impose a fine, a fee, a penalty on any of the people, a tax. It's all unconstitutional unless the second alternative is that since 1968, we've had a system of states that are no longer states of the Union, but are instead something like territories and or administrative divisions. If their territory, if TX is a territory, while the state of Texas is a state of the Union, within the state of the Union, you've got to have gold and silver. But in TX, you can do business with Federal Reserve notes. It's a different venue. I believe the explanation is that they've created a second venue, and this goes back to the definition at the beginning of the program. I mentioned Texas Penal Code 1.04 subsection D, which defined this state. All right, this state is usually code for the alternative territorial entity. You can call it a territory. You can call it an administrative division of the United States, but it is no longer a state of the Union, or that's my opinion.
So,
at least that's my opinion.
So what I'm hearing from you is that they've interwoven a commercial aspect into the laws that we have, almost like there's a doublespeak in between that and being able to decipher what part of it is a commercial or other type of law intermixed in with this. Am I interpreting that right?
You're basically correct. What it is you think you're going to play tennis. Okay, I'm going to the tennis match today. And you get your little tennis suit on, the rest of that sort of thing. And every time the ball comes your way, next thing you know, you got 11 guys charging at you who knock you to the ground. And say, that's not tennis. You guys aren't playing by the rules. And they're sitting back and laughing. No, you don't get it, lady. This isn't tennis. We're not playing. This is not a tennis court. This is a football field. And you have not perceived the venue in which we are operating.
So often they're jumping back and forth from which side that they want to work from, and so
I think they're almost always in this state.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I say that is because there's nobody who's working for a state government right now that's not being paid in Federal Reserve notes. And that's unconstitutional if they're in a State of the Union.
Are they not slaves, Al, working for companies?
Sure, they are, for lack of a better term, and I don't mean to offend anybody, while the rest of us are a bunch of field niggers, these guys are house niggers.
Amen.
But they're just as big a bunch of slaves as we are, at least in this state.
What are your thoughts about Lincoln and Lysander Spooner?
I don't know. I don't have any particular thoughts on Lysander Spooner. Lincoln, I don't know. You know, I mean,
was Lincoln a mass murderer?
Yeah, you can make those kinds of arguments, and the rest of that, it's something that, you know, I mean, there goes something that was just a kind of national insanity. And I don't know what to say about that. I mean, you know, you can make statements about Adolf Hitler and Pol Pot and Joseph Stalin and the rest of that sort of thing. And some of these things are beyond logic and beyond reason. You just look at it and you see sometimes societies just seem to go mad. Right? And the Civil War was a kind of madness. And how do you go back and assess it rationally? And say, well, this is what happened. I don't know. I don't have anything. I don't have anything intelligent to say about Lincoln or Lysander Spooner to speak of. I'm just not.
Yeah,
just
of course.
Not.
In 1871, Spooner wrote a Constitution of No Authority,
mm-hmm.
and I read that thing twice, and I think he hit it on the head. As far as Lincoln was concerned, Lincoln. Well, I don't think he was actually loyal to the original vision for the country, at least as the common people perceived that vision. And I think we can basically trace it to the various national banking and currency acts during his administration while he was propagating the war. And
all about the money.
Yeah. And unfortunately, again, you know, when the, you know, the Bible says the borrower is servant to the lender.
And some versions say the borrower is slave to the lender.
Yeah, which I think is more appropriate to what we're dealing with today, because I think the American people, you know, especially since the Administrative Procedures Act near the end of World War II, the creation of the United Nations, after the Congress or the Senate, I think, had rejected it during Wilson's administration. We can say, too, the assassination of JFK. I think the country has been completely flipped. I think it's much more of a communist state than we
absolutely
realize.
We've been communist ever since we adopted democracy. Like I say, under the democracy, the way you determine the difference between any form of government is by determining the first question is who is sovereign. For example, in a monarchy, who is sovereign? The monarch, the one man, mono, the one guy at the top. He is the sovereign. You go to an aristocracy, you have an elite group who are sovereign. It could be 10, 20, it might be 50 or 100 families. All right, but it's a limited number of people. They comprise an aristocracy. The rest are subjects. You go to a republic, and a republic merely means that all the people get to participate in government. That's all it means. If you want to grow up to be president, you can grow up to be president. All right, anybody can be president. Anybody can be dog catcher. If you want to jump in, jump in. Take your shot. All a republic means is it's not restricted, but a republic doesn't necessarily mean that everyone is a sovereign. It's the republican form of government says you're a sovereign, I'm a sovereign, Melody is a sovereign. You tell the difference between these forms of government according to who is sovereign. I got started on that. What was my point? Does anybody know?
Oh, that's okay. It's such a mishmash sometimes,
I swear. It is. It's one of those things. You know, I've been trying to understand this stuff for 28 years now. And I guarantee you, I spent the first 17 in a state of serious confusion. And the fundamental reason was I was reading case law operating on the assumption that they were writing the case law so I could understand it. Right? And what I came to understand is that since 1933, when you get an important case, the Supreme Court will write that case essentially in two simultaneous languages. They'll write it one way for the dummies like me. They'll read and say, well, yeah, I agree with that. And they'll write it another way using key terms where people who are intelligent and knowledgeable and sophisticated, they'll get an entirely different meaning. And what they do is they're concealing things. They write not to illuminate, they write to conceal.
Okay, now what would be the books that they would be writing and putting those interpretations?
Not books, court cases.
Okay.
Court decisions.
Okay.
All right. I can't give you a good example. I can just tell you it's been a long time since I've talked about this or thought about it one way or another, but I'd been at it for 17 years before I realized they're trying to conceal. That's why it was so hard for me to read this stuff. Once you understand they're trying to conceal the truth, not in every case, but in a lot of them, and especially the big ones, once you understand that, then you start to read and you start looking for the hook. You start looking for what's missing. You learn to read the white on the page as well as the black. And that's when all of a sudden you begin to see, oh, you sneaky sons of guns.
So in other words, they knew all along that it was all based on a fallacy.
Well, I don't know what you mean by all along.
I mean, if it's consistently concealing, then they know there has to be some major fallacy. I would figure that they're trying to hide, or they're just always going to be different fallacies.
They're going to try to hide the concept that you are endowed by your Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that they, at least at the state level, have an obligation to secure those rights. That's what they're going to try to hide from my perspective. You know, I mentioned early on, I got into the study of the law. The last thing I expected that would happen is that it would bring me back to God. But you get into it deep enough and you begin to see the spiritual foundation. And you begin to understand that what we're dealing with is spiritual warfare. This is just another variation on the spiritual warfare that's been going on since the time of Genesis. And it's been the fundamental reality, at least in the Western world, for several thousand years. Spiritual warfare. Are you made in God's image? Are you endowed by your Creator with certain unalienable rights? Of course, the endowment statement is not found, you know, it's in the Declaration of Independence. You can't trace that back exactly to early parts of the Bible. It's there, but it's not express. If they can get you to appear in any other capacity, they can own you. It's like the laws we bumped into declare us to be animals. That's not a joke. That's not just a casual mistake.
No,
They know what they're doing.
Right.
And this is spirit. They understand the difference between if you're an animal, you're not a man made in God's image. They don't have to pay any attention to you. This goes back. It has a spiritual foundation. I'm not suggesting that the local judge or the cop or whatever, he understands us. But the people who devised this system and put it together, the people very much up at the top, and they'd be a relative handful. They get it. They understand. They understand the Bible better than you and I and Lark will probably ever understand it. And they are using those principles in the Bible to get us. And because we be dumb, they succeed.
I think the country went to hell with the creation of public education by a socialist back in the 1830s in this country. And I understand that the people were willing to accept such a thing because the common people were looking for a cheap way to get educated. After all, the parents were not really qualified to educate their own children for the most part. At least the largest swath of the population, shall we say the common people. And we have been dumbed down.
Yeah, we've been dumbed down. I agree with that.
And that's why I always say that socialism is a system of arrested development. Yeah. Because so long as somebody is kept dumb by way of the technology that we call language, and language is constantly being used against the common person, then we are forever the victims.
If you don't want to learn to read, write, speak. If you're more interested in watching Dancing with the Stars than you are at cracking open a dictionary or learning grammar, that's correct. If you're willing, if you think it's cool to be, oh, you know what I'm talking about. You understand what I'm talking about? You want to do that? You are going to live in bondage all your life, and your only escape will be violence.
Now, something that I've been studying for the past 6 years, Al, is what we call communitarian law. Mm-hmm. And I never gave it much credence until I discovered a contract clause known as the supremacy of communitarian law. And when I realized that it tied in with the Earth Charter and the federal government signing on to this by way of a memoranda of agreement, so-called, in lieu of a treaty, I realized that this language of sustainable development and its product, what we call today Agenda 21, is really what accelerated what we're seeing today. And I think it was part of a long-term plan that was implemented. We can trace it back to the Fabian Society, 1884. Basically what the Fabians were about was something called gradualism or incrementalism.
Yeah.
By which the crown would, in effect, recover their American cousins and bring them to the bosom of the sovereign authority in the city of London. And I rather think this is what's happening today with communitarian law, because communitarian law is really just pure socialism. It calls for corporatism, what we also call fascism, to coexist and work with what we call communism, or what de Tocqueville called soft despotism, or what we also know as democracy. And it's basically just pure socialism of the, we can say the left and the right variety, but the worst features of it all is that it's grounded in the language of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is a secular humanist instrument. And they in fact drew a lot of the language from Thomas Paine, who himself was a secular humanist of his day. Americans think that Thomas Paine was an American hero of the Revolution, that he was an American. And yet he's celebrated today as one of the top 100 most famous Britons.
Hmm.
We look at the United Nations today, and we look at the Commonwealth of Nations, so-called, and then we look at all those satellite states in Africa and Asia that at one time or another were basically owned by Great Britain, including India. Then we see that they're the largest voting bloc in the United Nations.
Right.
And I actually think that a very important document is the excise portions that were transcribed from the very long-winded speech by Congressman Thorkelson in 1940 that was left out of the U.S. congressional record, and which you can read online. Just do a search, U.S. Congressional Record, 1940, British Israel World Government. And what's so fascinating to me is that this was before Pearl Harbor, before we were induced into another war, just like we had been induced as a nation into World War I. And the creation of the Pilgrim Societies. And when we go back to people like Kant and then Hegel, and then the adoption of the Hegelian dialectic as a means to confuse the people and keep them come and going, we understand that the abiding principle behind government today is to unite around the principle of instilling fear as opposed to uniting around the principle of extolling love. And then the problem with the church in America, the Christian church in particular, is I think that they were infiltrated early on. We saw the rise of the social gospel movement in this country and the adoption of the so-called kingdom message. And the pastors and the preachers across the nation were teaching socialism. They were teaching socialism as something that was a teaching from Christ.
But, Lark, wasn't everything infiltrated? I mean, they didn't leave anything unturned.
There's no doubt. And when you're speaking to issues of language, as Al correctly points out, we can all become slaves simply because we don't understand the nature of this technology called language. You know, people can use the words libertarian, communist, Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, and you can be talking to people and they'll just sit there and nod their head like they agree with what you're saying, but there are so many varying definitions for these words that they make no sense. There's a guy named Jeff Riggenbach who wrote a book about revisionist history that you can find at Mises.org, and he talks about that in that book. How these words have changed in terms of their meaning since the time that they were brought into the English language. That word terrorism actually came from the Reign of Terror during the French Revolution. And it was coined by the Jacobins. The first famous American terrorist in American history was John Brown. And there's so many things that are just easily conflated and confused. But you can talk within a group of 10 people, Al, and speak about a republic, and you will not get a consistent definition for that word republic among hardly any of those people.
I agree with you, but it gives you, that's a source of great strength. The average man doesn't have a clue to what he's talking about. If you're willing to make the effort where you really learn what you have to say and why, and you can explain it, you know, I have yet to meet a man who can talk for 10 minutes without contradicting himself.
I think that's true with everybody.
Yeah, just about.
You're so right.
Just about. And if you can manage to get to a point where you're not one of those people, again, if you can deliver ideas in a way, if you can communicate them in a way where people can understand them, and you can do it in a way where you're not contradicting yourself, and you have to really, it takes years of study. It's not the sort of thing you just go to, you know, let's go back to eighth grade or get our high school GED, and then we'll be able to read, write, and speak properly. You know, I published, you may have seen this on the internet, I published an article back in the Anti-Shyster, probably back about 1995, thereabouts, and the article was, we got a copy of an eighth grade examination, final exam for eighth grade students someplace in Nebraska, if I recall correctly, from 1900. And I don't remember. There were probably 50 questions on the test and a little bit of an essay, and I don't know, some math. There's math, and there's a bunch of things on this final exam for eighth grade students. I guarantee you 80% of the people graduating from college right now couldn't pass that exam, and maybe 90%. It was astonishing to see how much children can learn if somebody will make an effort to actually educate them.
Yeah, when I did an interview with John Taylor Gatto, I mean, he got into that particular test. And I mean, you had people like Thomas Jefferson and various people in history that were actually, I mean, leading armies and running plantations and whatever by the time that we're just still, you know, have kids in junior high.
So. I understand.
So we held them back.
We've held them back. We've trusted others to do our job. You know, the big problem is you trust the government. The government relies. They want us. Trust us. We're here to help you. Bull crap. No, they're not. The government hasn't been here to help me in my lifetime. I know people can point it in, you know, examples where somebody gets something out of the government. I understand that. Some people benefit. But the vast majority, you are being hustled, conned, exploited, extorted, robbed, impoverished. That's what government does. And they keep coming back and say, oh, trust us. And the people are dumb enough to do it. You know, the Constitution of the United States is a brilliant document in this regard. It is the first anti-government constitution. The whole reason we have checks and balances is because the founders didn't trust the government. They understood it was something like a necessary evil, but they plugged in three branches of government, so hopefully the three branches of government would keep fighting with each other. We have elections every 2 years. Why not just appoint these guys for life? It's because we don't trust them as far as we can throw the Washington Monument. That's why we give them 2 years, at least in Congress, and if they screw up, in theory, the people have the right to throw them out. Put somebody in, find a new con man to put him in there. Put in there.
Right? Well, I find it hard to even respect them anymore.
Well, I agree. The whole thing has become an overt, in-your-face, just extortion racket. There was a time 20 years ago, I don't know that the government was any more moral than it is now, but at least they would try to lie to us, and they would have the decency to try to bamboozle us into believing they were honorable. Now they don't even care. They just go out and rob. That's all. Ignore the Constitution. Ignore the law. They're the government.
Where is our remedy, Al?
From my perspective, first step is you got to have to educate yourself. It starts, you go back and you start cracking open the books and you start trying to understand some of these things. And you do it in the same sense. They had the Declaration of Independence, and they start out the Declaration, I'd have to quote it, it says, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected with another, and assume among the powers of the earth separate and equal station which laws of nature and nature's God entitled, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. It means you have to exhaust, it means something like, you have to exhaust your administrative remedies. You got to go through the situation where you write it. First, you figure it out and say, look, these guys, I didn't understand. After I read this book and this book and another book, why the damn government, you see what they're doing to us? You got to know what the government is doing to you. Not just in a way where you say, ooh, that hurts. You've got to be able to specify what exactly is it that they're doing to you. And then you petition for redress of grievance. And the government says, buzz off, and they won't pay any attention. And you petition again, and you petition again. You reach a point where you've created a moral foundation in case you have to go to violence. You can't just start shooting. You have to establish a case for your own righteousness, not only in the public eye, but even in your own mind. And you realize, by God, I'm doing the right thing. And you keep trying, and eventually you get to a point and say, okay, all right. You guys insist. It's just like they say here, in the Declaration of Independence, and they said, but when a long train of abuses but when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, meaning despotism, events is designed to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. All right? But you got to know what the problems are, and you've got to petition on a repeated basis, and you've got to go the extra mile, essentially, before you resort to violence. Any fool can pull out a gun and start shooting. And by the time he's done, you're going to have a bunch of innocent people get shot, and, you know, it just turns into a mess. You've got to, again, my notion, educate yourself, number one. Create the moral foundation for whatever revolution you might start later on. And in the process of educating yourself, you may educate enough people in government where some people in government begin to say, you know, I thought those people were crazy. Well, damn patriots and sovereigns and the rest of it. I thought they were crazy, but you know, when you talk to one of these guys, you know, they actually start to make a little sense. And the people might be on the jury, same thing.
Well, don't you also have to kind of study your enemy and the mechanics at which how we're being manipulated?
Yeah.
Because if you don't, if you're not able to recognize it, then I know many people that have amazing educations and still don't get what's happening to them.
I agree. Difference between education and conditioning. You know, the difference between education and training. You get dogs that can jump through hoops and rest that sort of thing. They're highly trained, but not necessarily well educated. There's a difference.
I mean, so many of us are being played, and you think, you know, year after year that they start to get it, and I just have to sit
have
back.
Time
and
to get it. You know,
right.
Back when I was a kid, I was a little boy back in 1950, and back then the total tax burden, the average tax burden, was about 15% of a man's income. My dad got to keep about 85 cents out of every dollar he earned, and because he was able to do that, he made enough money to allow my mother to stay home to raise me and my sister. Today, a young man gets to keep maybe 40 cents, 45 tops, probably about 40 cents now out of every dollar he earns. The rest, 60 cents, is going to local, state, and federal taxes, both the express taxes you pay and the hidden taxes that are built into everything you buy and sell. The result is a young man today doesn't make enough money to support a wife and let her stay home to raise the kids. One of the consequences of rising taxes is they are constantly squeezing us, and we are forced to work more and more and more just to try to stay even. And the average person doesn't have time to crack open a book. He's so busy running just to stay even, you know, in the squirrel cage. Keep that squirrel cage spinning. He doesn't have time to read a book. He comes home at night, turns on the television set, and, you know, Dancing with the Stars.
Well, you know, studying all these different laws and governments, but if you don't understand the mechanics of the corporate world, you would be missing out a major part of this, right?
I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree. I mean, this has gone so many bad directions, but you get down to fundamentals and it'll go to the money.
Right.
I mean, there's a bunch of things that you can mess with. There are a bunch of things you can, a bunch of different avenues and rabbit trails you can chase down. But if you want to understand what's happening, if you can master the money system, if you can grasp that, then you have a pretty good idea what's going on.
You know, I had a few documents that I had opened on my desktop in anticipation of our conversation today. And, speaking to precisely what you just said, I'd like to preface it first by saying that too many of us are so willing to adopt labels to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so we, in effect, enter into voluntary contract.
Yep.
By way of consent.
Yep.
Which is part of, speaks to a number of maxims in law. But John Taylor Gatto wrote a piece, and it's entitled Personal Solutions, Family Solutions, which I highly recommend for your listeners. But he begins with this, something he overheard on a car radio driving between Omaha and North Platte, Nebraska. If you have no time for your family, you want to ask yourself, why must I always be doing something? God made us human beings, not doings. And then he says, do nothing. Time is too precious to waste. And he says, it sounds like nonsense. But we have to ask ourselves, why are we these hamsters running this gauntlet or this spinning wheel all the time? And I think it has much to do with our understanding of the nature of our being, and the nature of property, and how it is that we adopt our own definitions for words, for all-important words, like well-being and even economy. Nowadays, we accept that economy is something that is called economics, and it's taught in universities. And we forget that there is a definition for economy. And the same for that word capital. I know that when I began my journey, and I haven't been at this near as long as perhaps the both of you, especially you, Al, but 6 years ago I found myself looking up in the encyclopedias and going over thoroughly these words so I could understand what they mean. But in conclusion, the second reference that I had opened up today, well, I had a few, but let me see, what is it called? But that's a very good piece, John Taylor Gatto. And the other piece was a piece by Murray Rothbard, Al. And
I recognize the name.
The title of the piece by Murray Rothbard, which is easily taken from online, it's a free read. It's just an essay, and it's entitled Karl Marx, Communist as Religious Eschatologist. And because Rothbard himself was a Jew, I think he understood Marx, who himself was a Jew. His mentor was Moses Hess, and his father was a rabbi. But I thought it was a fascinating article or essay because he laid out how it is a Jew thinks who is schooled in the Talmud and with his acculturation into Jewish tribalism, if you will, and then how a Christian looks at his own situation in relation to the state and to others within a so-called community. But I know that it seems like I may be blindsiding you, Al. I'm not in the least. I'm only suggesting this as being further examples for how we really all need to just really do just exactly as you suggest, and that's get educated. Yeah. We can't do anything. We can't accomplish anything without that. I'd like to ask you this, Al. Do you think a remedy might be found within what we call those types of law called maxims of law, and especially if we can look more clearly at international treaty law, especially as it relates to the states and or the federated United States of America?
Well,
do you think a remedy might be found there that all of us are missing?
I think a lot of this stuff is useful, but you're dealing with a system right now. I mean, you're talking about going to court and making an argument that a judge is going to buy.
The courts are too corrupt to even want to deal with them anymore, I think.
You know, you walk in as a non-attorney, and you've got two strikes against you. The probability that you're going to receive justice, at least if you're dealing, if you have a significant issue, and you are suing or are defending against any part of the government, you know, your probabilities of success are just not very high. The system has become, it's here to protect the system. It's no longer here to secure your rights and mine. That's what it was intended to do under the Declaration of Independence. It doesn't do that anymore. It's here to protect the system against you and me. And when you take your complaint to the very people that are part of the system that you're complaining about, it's like going to a mafia don and complaining that his guys out in the street corner are selling drugs. He's going to say, well, that's what we do. That's our job. He's not going to rule against his own soldiers selling drugs. He's going, well, that's what we do, and very difficult. It's not impossible, and I know that it happens, but
I wonder if we could frame an argument along these lines. How is it we can morally and consciously participate in organized crime? You follow me?
I do. I think you're arguing that the government itself has become a criminal enterprise, and therefore, if you can make that argument, you can say the government's a bunch of crooks and I don't want to participate in it, and that includes supporting it with paying taxes.
It also might begin with the money, too. The money is a debt instrument. You can't pay a debt with a debt.
Well, I know.
And this is sheer slavery. This money system puts us in a position of abject slaves.
Well, you know what it comes to me is you're looking at a situation where you've got every kind of log coming and going, and some a lot of it initially was legitimate, and now it's just become absurd. And then you realize that, again, most of it is still based on illusion, even the monetary system. So you got to find some point in between or step outside of that, either that system, to realize we don't have to function in the realms that they are. We can go back to what was our original intent.
That's exactly right. And do you know why it's true?
Why?
Because the system, if it's true that they've set up an alternative reality for, you know, you can say the territorial states, the administrative districts rather than the states of the union. If that hypothesis is correct, how do they get you into this alternative reality?
Getting your consent.
That's exactly right. And they have to allow you the choice. The system, as near as I can see, this alternative system is based on the presumption that you have consented to enter into it. And the implication is, anytime you get smart enough where you can manifest the idea, say, nope, I don't consent to play in that game.
Right.
I know a football field when I see one, and I ain't going to dress up in my tennis shorts to go play football. Right? I'm not playing in here. I do not consent to play in your game, in your field. And it's possible. There are people who've worked at this and people who are very astute who've been able to make these arguments with apparent success, but it doesn't mean that everybody has succeeded. It doesn't mean everybody even can. I mean, it takes some brains. It takes a while. You study this for a long time before you begin to, because it's not just hard to understand, it's hard to believe.
Al, what is your take about the putting into effect of the Noahide laws back in 1991 with Public Law 102-14, which categorized the federated and state citizens, the inhabitants of this land, into two groups, either Jew or Gentile? Are you familiar with that?
I'm not really familiar with the Noahide laws. I mean, there is so much up there. Anybody who walks into a law library, there's more books than you can carry.
And it's celebrated today as a national holiday.
Pardon me?
It's celebrated today as a national holiday, originally called Education and Sharing Day. It's sometime in April, I believe the 19th. And it was passed in honor of Rabbi Mendel Schneerson, who was the leader for many years in America of the Chabad Lubavitch sect. And they called him the living Messiah during his lifetime.
Well, you've got one. It's
not something that I'm knowledgeable about, and so I can't comment on it particularly. But, I mean, there's also a law that was passed probably 10 years ago now where they declared to be the Bible the Word of God. The way it works when you go to court, there's a million laws. I know I might be exaggerating, but you get to pick and choose which ones you want to use, and then you make an argument.
Well,
your facts to the law that you say, under this law, my facts mean I win. And then the judge and or jury get to say, nah, I don't think so.
Communitarian law posits that you have no rights that are not bound by duty and responsibility or obligation.
And then you're a slave.
That's right.
Yep.
And
when they say communitarian, that's close to communist, which is collectivist. The collective has the rights, and the subjects, the individual members of the collective, they have all the duties.
I think, though, our only remedy is... And I'm not sure it's found in the courts. Honestly, don't know about that. I think there are remedies for certain problems, but as it relates to status, and of course, let's not forget that communitarian law is international. It's universal.
I know. I've talked
to have people today that want to appeal before the International Court of Justice at The Hague, especially constitutional issues, and that's troublesome.
I've had people respond after me talking about the man or other animals laws relative to drugs. I've had people respond who heard we broadcast went out over shortwave. They picked up in England and down in Australia. And I've had responses from both England and Australia to tell me they looked into their laws. And they found similar phrases in the English definition of drugs and the Australian definition of drugs, where they, something similar, I don't remember if they found exactly man or other animals or animals other than man, I don't remember exactly what the phrase was, but they claim that they found basically the same thing in both England and Australia, which tells me that the presumption that the people are nothing but animals is probably a cornerstone or certainly fundamental part of the foundation for the New World Order.
Well, you know, Al, I think
your
experience with that particular aspect, I think, is crucial, which is why I was so excited to ask to visit with you today with Melody. I do think it's crucial. Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the U.S. Supreme Court recently said that our Constitution was a poor model for newly democratic countries to follow.
I agree.
And she actually pointed to the one of South Africa, which many people say is a communist state.
Well, I'm going to tell you, she said democratic. If she said it's a poor model for democratic countries, I agree. It was a model for a republican form of government, an entirely different system.
Yes, you're right there.
They hoisted the democracy off on us under the guise of the New Deal, as near as I'm able to understand. That's where they imposed the national democracy. That's where it started.
Right. However, I think it was planted in the people's minds through the churches back in the early 1800s. In fact, we could say it actually goes all the way back to the time of Plymouth Rock. But that's a subject for another day.
These are sophisticated concepts, and the average person, you know, the average person is not inclined to listen to 2 hours of people talking about this sort of thing. The average person is not inclined to read the books to try to get to the point where they can understand this on their own. And yet, the people that are running this world or purport to, they'll make that effort.
Ignatius
I guarantee
Loyola
people we're fighting against, they understand the Bible way better than I do.
Ignatius Loyola was proclaiming a new order at the time that he appealed to the Vatican for recognition for the Society of Jesus. And then we have Dr. John Dee, Francis Bacon, Isaac Newton, all alchemists. Basically describing how it is the intelligentsia and especially the nobility of Europe were planning on harvesting, if you will, the resources of the Americas. It's incredible. The more you research the you go ahead and say something there, Mel.
I was trying to look something up because I was trying to find
you're playing solitaire, aren't you?
But honestly, yeah. I think you're really one of the heroes of this movement because I think that your experience in that particular case, vis-a-vis the colloidal silver, and then your discovery of the animal, man is like other animals, I think this is key.
It's crucial. It's so important. And one of the things that's disturbed me is we made that discovery back 2006. All right? And I have been trying to promote this concept ever since. And I thought this thing was going to take off like a, you know, take off like a rocket, and people say, oh, my God. And, in fact, we haven't gained much traction with it. But here's the reason it's important. Here's the reason it's important. The definition of drugs that I'm talking about is the same definition of drugs that laid the foundation for the war on drugs initiated by President Nixon back in 1971. The war on drugs presumes the people to be animals. The war on drugs laid the foundation for much of the modern police state. I'll bet you half of what the cops do today involves drug-related crimes, and maybe more. I know that 70% of the people in the federal penitentiaries are there on drug-related crimes. All of that, that massive bureaucracy and the police state and this prison industrial complex with millions of tons of concrete and steel and the highest incarceration rate in the world, it is all largely based on a mere definition of drugs that presumes the people to be animals, and that presumption can be overturned anytime anybody wants to put the Bible together with that section and say, you can't call me an animal. I'm man-made in God's image. Put me in front of a jury. Convince a jury that they're nothing but animals, that their children are nothing but animals. The whole thing collapses if this one concept breaks loose and people begin to understand.
This is
why they dropped the case down there, in my belief, this is why they dropped the case in Austin.
And
they
this
understood
is
that
based...
if we went to court and we got a judgment and said, by God, you are men and women. We can't treat you like animals.
Yeah, the tentacles of that are far and wide.
The whole damn thing would collapse. Yeah.
Well, of course, in the Talmud, they will say that the Gentile, mm-hmm. or the Goyim, is not possessive of spirit.
Yep.
Mind, body, spirit.
Yeah.
Or mind, soul, and spirit, I mean
Who's
to say.
Who's the patriarch of the Jewish faith?
Was it Maimonides?
I'd say it's Abraham. He's also the patriarch for the Christian and Muslim faith. He was the first man to walk with God, so far as I understand the Bible. And he had a son, Isaac, and Isaac had a son, Jacob, who became Israel. Which tells
us what?
I'm astonished
that there was not enough Christians that said that spoke out about this public law 102-14 back in 92.
Probably.
I'm just astonished.
Here's my point. Abraham was a goy. There were no Jews until his grandson, Jacob. And yet, Abraham is the whole Jewish situation, as well as the Christian Muslim, all springs from Abraham. And it seems to me that the Jews got some splaining to do when they try to explain how it is that they have evolved from goy.
Well, I think a few very courageous Jewish writers have written to that quite eloquently, even in recent times. They basically expropriated that name under mostly fraudulent pretenses, I think.
Which name?
The word Jew.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, all of this stuff.
I mean, it wasn't even in the English language 150, 200 years ago.
I understand.
The word itself. But
the whole thing becomes, you start to look at this, and it's just, it's peculiar, and it's weird, and you begin to understand about history. They teach you history as if it's, you know, logical. Makes some sense. You go from point A to point B to point C in a logical order. You start to study this, and the whole thing looks like some sort of a bizarre LSD experience. It's like in a mosh pit where everybody's pushing and shoving and they're all on drugs, you know, and that constitutes history.
I think American people are facing a very grave threat today.
Absolutely.
And yet I think it calls for cool heads and good hearts to come together, as we're doing tonight. I think... more discussion and collaboration, and I totally agree with you. We need to be cracking some dictionaries and talking rationally amongst each other as opposed to speaking about reacting to fear. Because I don't think merely reacting to fear is particularly manly in these times.
You know, there's a passage in the Bible at Revelation, I think it's 21:8, and it's a laundry list of sins that will earn you damnation. And it includes adulterers and liars and murderers and sorcerers, and at the top of the list is those who fear. Or in some versions of the Bible, it says the cowardly. And the reason is because your fear is inversely proportional to your faith. If you really believe in God, if you're sincere in your faith, if you really believe that there's another life coming after this one, this isn't the real deal. This is just kind of like a dream, or for some people, a nightmare. But in the context of eternity, this is a triviality. Do you have faith? If you do, who cares if they kill you? Who cares if they take your house or your car or your boat or your kids or your wife or whatever? It's not a big deal. In the context of this life, from my perspective, you stand firm to the end. Passage in the New Testament says, those who stand firm to the end shall be saved. That's what I'm trying to do. I don't know that I'll have much of an impact on saving this country. And on one level, it's not my concern. I would hope that we can. And I hope I live to see it. But my fundamental business, stand firm to the end. And that will be, that's what I'm going to try to do.
Yeah, I interpret it as, this, like you're saying, it is a spiritual warfare, and this is where you have that opportunity to stand up and follow your precepts. And if you don't practice them, then what do you have to pass on to the future generations or any other existence besides this one?
I agree.
I read, I listened to somebody a few years ago on the radio, and he's some guy from Australia, and in essence what he said is that Americans need to reverse some unconscionable and or dishonorable contracts. And so I look at these maxims of law, like he who seeks the benefit must stand at the burden. Mm-hmm. Every man is presumed to intend the natural and probable consequences of his own voluntary acts. And that's a big deal among the communitarians. They want to induce man into slavery voluntarily.
That's exactly right.
The agreement of the parties makes the law of the contract.
Yeah.
The agreement of the parties overrides the law. And finally, this is the kicker, and this is where I think a remedy might arise. No injury is done by things long acquiesced in, because long sufferance is construed as consent. And I know you're familiar with those, Al. I wanted to share them with the audience.
Well, they can be useful.
Your court case in particular, I think, is really key. It is so crucial, this idea of equating to man as another animal.
Yep.
And it's really being, impressed upon us now when we look around and give so much.
We're being treated like animals.
Right.
Well, here's one of the things. Why do they teach evolution? Evolution sprung up, the concept sprung up about the same time they drafted that 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act to declare the people to be animals. The government insists that we teach evolution to the children, and if the children accept the idea that you are just an evolved animal, then you are not created by God. You don't have those God-given unalienable rights. You come up to an average young person today and you try to communicate this idea to them, and they say, well, evolution, we know about evolution. We're just advanced primates. That's all. If that's all you are, you have no claim. You can't put your argument together where you can hold it up in front of a jury, hold it up in front of the judge, and say, I am a man made in God's image. I'm endowed by my creator with certain unalienable rights. And here are the documents that say so, and I say it under oath, and I defy anyone to stand up under oath on the witness stand and say contrary. This is the truth, and I swear to it.
We have groups like people nowadays. Forgive me. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying I can make that claim, but these people who believe in evolution, they would see something like man or other animals, and it goes right by them. They don't realize the significance, and in that ignorance, they have forfeit their capacity to claim individual sovereignty, God-given unalienable rights. They're going to be chattel. They're going to be in bondage. It may be a polite bondage, but they're going to be in bondage.
Nowadays, we see groups like PETA, for instance, that are really militant about animal rights.
I know.
And so they want to pen us up and put us as zoo animals in a zoo in the cities. We've got Agenda 21, rapidly moving apace. Especially in those areas west of the Mississippi, they want to force people into large urban settings.
Yep.
They want them off the land, and they're groups like the Nature Conservancy and others are working overtime to steal people's property. The courts, of course. But I think it's I think what we're looking at is an implosion of the economy, and I think it's going to be a controlled demolition. I think, though, that I think it's important for Americans, and tell me what you think of this, Al, Melodies. We need to think as individuals, first and foremost.
Does that require?
Well, for me, it just goes, I look at things like the Ten Commandments.
I'm allergic to consensus.
I look at things like the Bible. And I look at your issues related to sovereignty and so forth. But I've also been steeped in this language of the sociologist, like Dr. Amitai Etzioni, who is a dual Israeli-American, the founder of the Communitarian Network. I can see how they've literally taken over not only the public school system in America through the NEA, for instance, and then also in academia through the Communitarian Network. It's amazing what they're teaching our best and brightest today.
Yep.
They're being indoctrinated. They're being brainwashed to become communitarians. And again, that's simply just a fancy way of saying collectivist.
Yeah. Now, when you started, you mentioned that you wanted people to think as individuals, and when my observation is that the fundamental requirement
with a covenant with God, by the way, Al.
Well, the essence of being an individual and being able to think for yourself is you must have confidence in your own two eyes, in your own two ears, in your ability. What does it actually look like to you? Don't tell me what everybody else says about it. Do you have the confidence to say, no, I don't think it looks, everybody else says this is something. It's blue, and I'm looking at it. I'm saying, no, it's green. You have to have a kind of confidence in the eyes, in your own capacity for perception. And if you can do that, then you can begin to think as an individual. On the other hand, if you're insecure about your ability to perceive, your ability to understand, then you're just going to nod your head, go along. When the judge says, do you understand the charge against you? You say, oh, yeah, yes, Your Honor. And one man in a thousand understands the charges against him in the sense of comprehending them.
That's a Marxist construct.
Of course.
Because they promote political correctness.
Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate. It's one of the things you have to deal with, that, you know, people feel insecure and they're unwilling to trust themselves. They would rather trust Barack Obama or, you know, name one. I don't care. Name any of them.
George Bush.
They'd rather trust them than trust their own perceptions.
Have you had any contact with Dean Gulcher?
Don't know the name. Doesn't ring a bell with me.
He has something called the Institution for Authority Research, and he studies something called the Diaprax. That's spelled D-I-A-P-R-A-X. Somehow, Al, I think it would be wonderful if, Mel, maybe we can help make this happen. Bring together Dean Gulcher. You can go to you can find him on the internet, G-O-T-H-C-E-R. Dean Gulcher, and just scan his work just a bit. There's been several interviews of him, I know, at RBN, among other networks. He's been on Genesis, and I think also Oracle.
I've missed him. I haven't caught him before either.
This man has a grasp of the dialectical process put into practice, which is where we get that word diaprax.
Okay.
And it goes to how men's minds are flipped and how we can learn to overcome not just this diaprax being used against us, but how it is that we can understand the workings of it and how it works on our own minds. Because we indeed have been acculturated and indoctrinated. I mean, when I found out about the Fed, I have to tell you, I felt like I had been born into slavery. Yeah. And no one knew enough to tell me that I had been. What do you
think,
Alex?
You've been born in ignorance is what you've been born into, and unless you escape it, you'll remain. Ignorance and slavery are almost synonymous.
Well, gentlemen, it looks to me like we're pretty much coming to a point in time when we'll need to summate our interview here. And if you, either one of you, have some closing comments, would you like to do so?
I can begin by saying that, Al, I'm a big admirer of yours.
Thank you.
And I'm so honored to, I feel very privileged to have had this conversation with you and Melody today.
Well, there's no honor in talking to me. I'm glad that people, I'm grateful if anybody listens. Believe me, there's more honor for me to say, oh my God, we got, somebody's listening.
Well, you know, especially since we're practically neighbors, Al, we really ought to think about getting together sometime. And
where do you live?
I'm over here in Richardson.
Well, then we are. I'm in Garland.
Yep. And I had a business for 12 years all over this metroplex and Forney and in Garland. So, I knew that. And Melody's up in Colorado, but she makes it down to Texas from time to time.
And I go down to Sherman. So,
Melody, thank you.
And I want to thank you two gentlemen for a great conversation, and may have to do this again at some point here. So thanks again, Alfred and Lark.
Thank you. Good talking to both of you. Look forward to doing another time.
Okay, thank you. Goodbye.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Thank you.